point, you've probably asked yourself a question about your career. Am I in the right role? Am I on the right team? Is this even a path I want to keep walking? But there are a number of smaller questions that can help you think about the bigger one. Like, why am I feeling the need for change? What's currently making me unhappy, or what would I like to be different? This week, I'm delighted to have Jane Gunn, aka the Barefoot Mediator, back on the podcast. Jane works with people in times of challenge and crisis, helping them navigate through transition and change. And she's just written a book called The Mole and the Mountain, which helps us connect with our inner wisdom in a really approachable way. So if you're wrestling with a tricky decision or you find yourself looking to other people for advice, this conversation is for you. If you're in a high-stress, high-stakes job like medicine and you're feeling stressed or overwhelmed, burning out or getting out are not your only options. I'm Dr. Rachel Morris, and welcome to You Are Not a Frog. Are you constantly stressed and thinking about work? Does your laptop come with you on holiday? Your to-do list have permanent residence in your brain, and your worry about how to handle the latest crisis wake you up in the small hours? Then it's time to get your life back, and that's exactly what our brand new online course will help you do. It's a 60-minute reset for healthcare professionals to shift your mindset so you can set boundaries and limits around your work without the endless guilt that you've not done enough. It's just £27 and you can get instant access now when you go to shapestoolkit.com/getyourlifeback.
I'm Jane Gunn and I'm known as the Barefoot Mediator, and I help people in times of change, challenge and crisis, exactly the times we're living in now.
I love your title, Jane. I love the Barefoot Mediator. Now, you've been on our podcast before, so people will have heard you before. But for those listeners who are new, just tell us why you're called the Barefoot Mediator.
Well, it goes back to lockdown, really, and literally sitting at my desk as I am now with no shoes on and probably no socks either, literally barefoot, doing my professional work as a mediator. And I think I just made a joke to a client, said, "Oh, I'm the Barefoot Mediator," and it stuck. And then I thought, what is a barefoot mediator? And to me, the skills and tools and mindset that I use in my work as a mediator, very often it's seen as something that's only used in legal disputes or commercial disputes. But in actual fact, I think we could all benefit from using those skills and tools and mindset. So it was my idea that we should expand the reach of mediation and everybody to be able to use those tools in their everyday life.
A bit like the naked chef, right?
Yes, it's only my feet that are naked.
I was going to say, it's a new brand for you. You could like go up a notch and be the naked mediator, but
I might lose some clients, I think, Rachel.
You might gain some as well. You never know. That would just put a spin on it. Anyway, we digress. Jane, we've had you on before and we've had some brilliant podcasts with you about like how to say the thing that really needs to be said, how to raise issues, all those sorts of things. And I'm really interested in the direction that your work has taken, because you've actually just produced a book called The Mole and the Mountain. Jane, tell us, why did you write this book? What was it in response to?
So somebody very early on said that what I do, the service I provide, is making molehills out of mountains. And so in my two previous books, the illustrator, Simon Elinas, who's illustrated this book, always put a little mole. And then gradually Morris has come to life. And I just wanted to write a book about Morris and the mole and what that meant. And actually, in the times we're living in, which seem to be, I describe as a cycle of crises, it seems to me that for a lot of people, we're living in quite dark times, a lot going on for many, many people. And that was so during the last 3 or 4 years. So the story is about how do we deal with dark times? How do we come out of the dark and find a vision and a way forward? And I've always found my clients' journey, if you like, that they go on when I'm working with them in a mediation or in some kind of conflict process, that they go on a specific journey. And there are about 4 points that this book is based on a little map which appears at the beginning of the book. But there are several points on the map where I find my clients get stuck, really. And so I've illustrated all of those points and taken Morris on this journey from this darkness into finding a vision and finding what I call the mountaintop of experience, a place that's where he was aiming to get to, and a place that's sort of lighter and more energetic.
And so it's all about helping people get unstuck with journeys that they're on, with life transitions and life changes.
Definitely. And so it can be used in many, many different scenarios. And so I've got a couple. My niece, for example, is about to transition. She's about to move back from living in New York for about 7 years to the UK. And she said she was finding it very helpful to think through that transition. Where were they getting stuck? What were the challenges? What vision did they want to have? And another young friend has been using it again for a transition, or thinking about a transition from the kind of work he's doing to a different kind of work environment.
And do you find that people get stuck in exactly the same places, in exactly the same order, or is it different for everybody?
I think it's different, but there's a place in the book and in that map called the Murky Swamp of Reality. And I think we all get stuck there from time to time. It's a place where, and I do liken it to a swamp. You know, if you were stuck in a swamp and you start thrashing around, all you do is make the water muddier. It becomes less clear and you really can't see. You know, it's just, you're just surrounded by mud and weeds. And it's how do you, in that moment of not knowing, how do you go into the darkness, which is further into yourself, which is questioning yourself and your reasoning and where you're going? How do you take that journey within to yourself as well and think, where am I really trying to get to? What's holding me back? And so that's the phase in what I would call in a mediation, where we're what we call exploring. We're looking at what were our expectations, what is our experience, or what evidence do we need to kind of help us make the decision and make the transition. And we surely don't want to stay stuck in the swamp for very long.
Why do you think people get stuck in that swamp of reality?
I think often it's that we don't want to do the internal questioning. So I find even in my commercial mediations that people want to rush through this phase of exploring more deeply what's going on, to understanding themselves as well as understanding the situation they're in. And, you know, that can be quite difficult. It can take quite some time. So I often find clients say, well, let's not bother about that. Let's just jump to what the solution would be. So this is really the most important place of the map, although it's perhaps one of the sort of hardest places. And if you can imagine being in a swamp, you know, you want to get out as quickly as possible. But sometimes you've got to relax into it and think, what am I learning in this place? What's this all about?
That's really interesting, because I think that happens in coaching as well. Often people come to you with like a, I want to get this to the solution. I want to solve this problem. And you go, okay, well, what is it that you want? Like, what's really important? What do you want? And that completely stumps them, because they've been so fixated on solving the problem that when you say, well, actually in the long term, what do you want? And I'm not judging anyone either, because I've been sort of thinking about like my work quite recently in my career. Like, what do I actually want? What does anyone actually want in their lives? And the problem is, if you don't know that, then you go off chasing that career or that solution to your problem. And you might get there to find that, oh my goodness, it's the wrong solution. It doesn't actually even work.
Well, there is that wonderful book by Jon Kabat-Zinn, which is Wherever You Go, There You Are. It's so true, isn't it? You know, you can search after all the toys and all the experiences, and then there you are. And that's what we're experiencing, or that's what we're exploring. Who are you? Who are you being? Who do you want to be, rather than what do you want to do and what do you want to have?
And I'm fascinated that you've come to this through actually working in mediation, because in my mind, mediation is, yeah, there's a problem, you need to solve it and make sure you're all on the same page. But actually, it sounds like there's a lot of quite deep work that has to go on for both parties in a mediation.
Yeah, and I think they often do, as we say, they often try and avoid that and think, oh, this is a legal or it's a commercial problem. It's nothing to do with us as human beings. You know, let's just get it sorted. And it's not really the case. You know, wherever we go, again, there we are as human beings, and we have to deal with our humanity, if you like, and our human conditioning.
It's always a human problem, let's face
it. It's always a human problem.
Side note, we had a tree surgeon over recently just to sort of clear a few branches. And I sort of said, oh, you know, so how do we manage these trees in general? And he said to me,
trees are not a tree problem. Trees are a human problem. Trees are great, just as they are. It's the humans that get in the way and go, oh, that branch is overshadowing my fence or something like that. So how do you help people really know what they really want when they are in that swamp of reality?
I did a blog last week. What was it called? Bobby's Question or something. It's about a young guy who says, I'd love a red sports car. And you go, well, why would you love a red sports car? Well, if I had a red sports car, I'd have more people noticing me. Oh, so you'd have more people noticing you. Anyone in particular? Yes, I'd have Rachel noticing me, or maybe. Okay, well, what is it about? So you go on through and through the questions, asking deeper and deeper questions. So what is it really about the red car that you want? And often it's about how we feel about ourselves. Well, I would have more people liking, loving me, acknowledging me. And it's not that every problem is about that, but more than anything, we want to feel good about ourselves and we want to feel acknowledged, heard and paid attention to by others. And if we feel that we don't matter and that people don't care, then we're looking for that. And that would be so in a workplace. You see, even in a workplace conflict, when we're not happy at work, it's usually because we don't feel respected and acknowledged, or that we're able to provide the service to our patients or clients that we'd really like to do.
So interesting. I was listening to a podcast yesterday where I think Greg McKeown, the guy who wrote Essentialism, was talking to Tim Ferriss. Massive fan of Greg McKeown. You know, I recommend his book Essentialism to everybody. And he was saying that, you know, every single conflict in the world or argument between people is about, at the bottom line, is do I matter? Do I matter to you? All around adult attachment, you know, I need to matter in this case.
Those two questions, do I matter and am I heard? And essentially the mediation process is about enabling people to answer those two questions and to hear each other.
So if it's not a case of mediation, if it's a case of like, should I change jobs or should I move departments or should I step up and go for that role, where does that come in the swamp of despair? Or no, hang on, not swamp of despair. I think that's Pilgrim's muddling up my journey books. The swamp of reality.
The murky swamp of reality. I think, again, it's so, you know, going more deeply into that question, why do you want to change jobs? What is it about your current job that makes you feel unhappy, uncomfortable, unsettled? And then again, I know people don't always like to answer the question, but where are you going to? And as much as what does that job look like? What does that job feel like? How would you feel differently if you were in a different position? Because we can always be chasing salary and title and, you know, lots of hard things, if you like. But what are the softer elements of what you really want for you? You know, I think it's important to think, how would I feel differently at the end of a working day in a different, or how would I like to feel differently at the end of a working day in a different position?
And there are always those sort of four basic needs, aren't there? To feel happy and contented and alive and human, and then to deeply connect with other people, to do something with some meaning and purpose, and to be learning and growing and stuff. And if you can get all of that, that's what we should be aiming for, isn't it? Not the, oh, that mountain over there, because that looks like I might feel like that if I'm at the top.
Yeah. And I think today in many professions, and probably as much in medicine, is that people are finding a disconnect. They are disconnected from human beings. You know, they're not able to connect as effectively with their colleagues, with their patients, with their clients. And we are feeling that disconnect.
Just moving on to the stages of a journey, typically what do people then encounter next? Once they've really worked out what they want, or they've got much more of an idea, what then happens next to sort of stop them?
Well, there's quite a few little characters, which you'll have seen, Rachel, on the map. And one of them is the Dragon of Doubt. And, you know, the Dragon of Doubt looms large for all of us. We begin to doubt that, is that really what I want? Or why do I want it? Or perhaps I'm not worthy of having it. Or perhaps I don't even have the qualifications or the ability to get there. So the Dragon of Doubt looms quite large. And there are another couple of characters on the map. One is the tiger and one is the eagle. And those represent either, again, inner feelings or actually perhaps real people who are either holding us back or enabling us. So a tiger I describe as being something or someone that's on your back. It's kind of nagging you. It's kind of being a bit of a bully, really, micromanaging you, if you like. Whereas an eagle is much more floating above you. It's got your back. It's looking out for you, but it's not sort of trying to direct where you go. And one of the key principles of mediation is what I call self-determination. You can have a map, you can have a compass, you can have some guides along the journey, but at the end of the day, you decide. It's up to each of us to make those decisions. And we can't be looking for someone to come and save us. And it doesn't matter, you know, whether that's a politician or a famous person who we follow as an influencer, or whether it's a guide or a mentor. They're not there to save you. They're there to guide you. You decide at the end of the day where you want to go. And then you step out with confidence on that journey.
That's so interesting. I've been talking to lots of people recently who, when they've realized they want to change something in their work, or when they realize they're stressed and they need to sort of go off sick, have been really disappointed and felt really let down by the leadership where they work. So either their partners or their colleagues or the HR department or their clinical leaders, things like that. And the more I hear this, the more I'm thinking, well, of course not. Because if you're all working together, so if you're working in a practice and you know you need to start looking after yourself and take some time off because you're getting quite unwell, and you go to the senior partner who's also experiencing all the stress that you're experiencing, and you say, well, I'm really struggling, then they have such a conflict of interest, don't they, in being able to support you in the way that they would do normally if they were just a friend or a mentor or an eagle. I guess what I'm thinking is, like, the eagle, like, is above the situation. They're not in it. The tiger's probably on the ground having to deal with all the same crap that you're having to deal with. And so it's not that these people don't want to support you. I'm sure they really do and mean very well, but everybody, when anything happens, their immediate thought is, what does that mean to me? What does it mean for me? So if one of your colleagues is really saying, I'm really struggling, you try and be as supportive as you can, but actually deep down you're going, oh, how am I going to fill that rota? When are they going to come back? This isn't actually very fair, because I think that. And then so I'm saying to people, of course, they're not going to be able to support you in the way that you want them to. And so they will then start to say things that make you feel doubtful about stuff. But presumably in mediation, it's really obvious that the person you're sort of against or having to be in the mediation with, of course, they're going to have their own back and you've got your own back. And that's probably why the mediation's happened in the first place. But we don't quite recognize that in the normal interactions.
What we don't also recognize, and another character very early on in the map, is someone with lots of baggage, burdens and baggage. And in fact, it happened to me the other day. I like to mountain bike, and I was coming down a track, quite a narrow track, and there was somebody in front of me, and I always shout out rather than ring my bell. So if I ring my bell, people jump out of their skin. So I just shout out, bike behind. So I shout out, bike behind, to this guy. And he turns to let me pass. But as he turns, he's got this enormous backpack on, which actually blocks my way even more. And of course, when you look at someone head on, when you're talking to them, you can't see the burdens and baggage that they're carrying, which is what you're describing. And we can't see our own because it's on our back. And this is all the stuff that's, you know, as you're describing, weighing us down. What else is going on in my life? What has gone on in my life before? What leadership have I experienced? What childhood experiences have I had? All of this stuff is on our back and on somebody else's back. And again, you know, it's not always appropriate to get it out and unpack it all. But sometimes we need to just acknowledge that's there. You know, they must have their own stuff. I've got my own stuff. Is there some of it I need to get out and leave by the wayside, lighten my load and lighten my journey? But just knowing that that's there and it's there for everybody. I did a little mini video not long ago about what's in your cup. And of course, if somebody bumps into you in the corridor and you spill your coffee, you say, oh, it's your fault. You spilled the cup. No, it was depended what you had in your cup and how full your cup was as to what you spilled and where it went. So we just have to remember these things.
It's bringing me back to last week. I was on the train and spilled my cup of tea over somebody else's laptop.
Oh, no.
Awful. It was honestly one of the most traumatic experiences I've had recently. I felt so bad. Anyway, they were so nice about it. And actually, it was okay. The laptop still worked. But the thing I really found difficult was I just thought to myself, actually, I'm not sure I would have been so gracious and nice in that situation. It really made me look at, and I guess, bringing us back to, you know, other people's baggage and stuff like that. If you're going on a journey, if you're making a change, if you're making a decision and you tell someone else about it, A, they've got all that baggage and they've got their own responses. And a lot of their response to you is about their own, you know, their own worries about things and their own opinions. And I think a lot of people's responses to you is just it, but what it does, it's holding a mirror up to them, isn't it? It's holding it, and they might, it might set off some uncertainty in them and make them think, well, am I doing the right thing? And so what you get is a defensive reaction, right?
Well, their advice to you is probably their advice to themselves, not to you. And the other thing that's occurring to me in this part of the conversation, Rachel, is we're all reacting from fear, mostly. This fear-based reaction, and it's more prevalent than ever because we're living very much in a fear-based society. There's so much fear in the media, you know, everything is fear-based. And we then tend to react even more from a fear perspective. And of course, that doesn't facilitate logical thinking at all. It makes us very restricted in our thinking, very linear in our thinking. And so only when you can sort of let go of that fear and say, but what about the opportunities and the possibilities? And, you know, where might this lead? But, you know, other people are probably advising us or wanting to hold us back because of their own fear for us and for themselves too.
Yeah. And I think one's nearest and dearest are often almost some of the worst culprits, aren't they?
Yes, for sure.
Well-meaning relatives who don't really know what's going on, but think actually, well, there's that path you're going down, and you know, that means financial security for you and your family, and that's going to worry me if you don't have that. So I'm going to give you this advice. And that thing about making decisions from a place of love opposed to a place of fear, and you know, I call that being in the corner and being triggered. It's quite hard, isn't it, to notice when we're in which mode. I guess conscious leadership would say, are you above the line or below the line making that decision?
It is hard. I mean, I use love as a sort of acronym to say, are you listening to yourself and to others? Are you observing what's actually going on within yourself and outside? Verify means to check. Let me just check in with myself. Let me check in with others. Let me be sure. And then E stands for empathy or ease. But also, am I being thoughtful and empathetic? And then fear is all about fighting, engaging, being adversarial and needing to be right. So those are the two. How I use both of those to see whether we're in one mode or the other.
I love that. That's really helpful because I found myself a bit below the line in the fear thing recently, maybe in a couple of meetings I've been in. And actually, part of the battle is just noticing that, actually realizing it, isn't it? If you realize you're below the line in acting out of fear, oh, that's interesting, I'm there. And then the shifting, yeah, L, listen. Actually, okay, let me just shift into listening and observing. And if I can then start to act like that, that immediately will move me out.
So for example, in a meeting, Rachel, where, you know, you might, so if you are acting out of fear, you might be triggered to respond or be defensive to somebody else in a meeting. Whereas if you were to stop yourself and you could say, let me just ask a question or let me just check. So the verifying me, I thought I heard you say this. I'd just like to clarify what we're saying here. So you just step back into that listening, verifying, checking mode to go, give myself a bit of space. Let me just check what's actually going on and what I'm really hearing.
Getting curious, isn't it? That's my favourite word to flip me. It's like, get curious, not defensive. I get it. You're pushed for time. And with over 200 episodes, how do you know which is going to be the one that lifts you out of the saucepan and back to thriving at work? Never fear, the You Are Not a Frog podcast quiz is here. Find out if you're a super squirrel, brilliant badger or mighty mole, and I'll send you a personalised playlist with the top 5 episodes that will make the biggest difference to you. Discover your top of the hops, top 5 episodes, sorry, and leap into your happiest, thriving self again. Just go to youarenotafrog.com/quiz. And interesting, back to this thing about the mentors and people that give you advice, whether they're tigers or eagles, I think one of the issues is that there are people that we really respect that have been fantastic mentors that have given us brilliant advice. And that might be more in context. It might be, say, I'm thinking there's lots of doctors that listen to this podcast. So they might be a clinical mentor. They trained us, or a senior consultant. We really appreciate their wisdom on that. And then we go to them about another decision entirely. It's about something else. And we expect them to have the same sort of wisdom on that as they've had on other things. I read an article recently about having different mentors for different things. I think that's where we come across and think, oh, Bob doesn't think that's a good idea, what I've just told him. Well, you know, yeah, because Bob's not an expert in that bit. He's an expert in neurology, but not in that. I mean,
so true, Rachel. And I do think we also shouldn't underestimate the impact of having younger mentors as well. We always think a mentor should be somebody older and wiser, but it's not necessarily so. And it may be that sort of asking a younger colleague what they think or for their thoughts would be just as effective or even more effective, because they've maybe got a different perspective, particularly as medicine's moving so fast, you know, and somebody who's much, much more senior to us may have a very different perspective on the workplace and the opportunities and the options than somebody who's younger would have.
Yeah, definitely. We definitely see that. I'm Gen X, apparently, and we definitely see in the millennials are much more focused on work-life balance, actually. And we, the generation above me, are they the boomers? I don't know who they are, but medicine seems to be much more of like this vocation that you gave your entire life to, that, you know. And so actually, I think we could take a lot of advice from millennials who've got it right, because if we don't have the right work-life balance, nobody's getting any better, really, because we just then end up burning ourselves out.
And I think in law, where I come from in medicine, there was always this sense in that you did, you know, push yourself really, really hard at the beginning, and you worked very long hours for very little pay. And, you know, it was kind of, well, if I've done it, then the next generation ought to be able to do the same. And we've stepped back from that a bit, and that isn't the right approach anymore.
That's really helpful, actually. I think identifying when you're making a decision, is this person an eagle, someone who really has got good perspective and actually is independent, doesn't have a vested interest in me carrying on fulfilling that role that I'm fulfilling now, or carry on doing the same thing, or whatever the decision is. Yeah, I guess it's the independence and the lack of vested interest. Or the head tiger, they're sort of in it with us. And actually, me even asking that's probably sparking a little bit of fear in them. So they're coming back very defensive.
And that there also might be that in that element of those characters in ourselves as well. So also understanding where we're being more tiger or more eagle.
Lovely. So, okay, that's really helpful. What comes next then?
Well, the next point is then this sort of decision-making part. So you come to what I call the bridge of courage, and to go forward, you've got to cross the bridge. But to the left-hand side is something called the deep abyss. And for example, you know, I can give an example from a mediation even, is that often people in mediation end up spending or potentially spending or losing more money on their legal fees than they stand to gain. And so that would be ending up in the nowhere abyss. In terms of a conflict escalating, you get to the stage where I mustn't lose face here. And, you know, if both people are going to say, I'll do anything not to lose face, then you potentially end up losing everything or everything that you had the opportunity to gain. So it's really here a decision. It's a decision making place to say, what are the options? What are the possible options? And I think one of the challenges we have, particularly in society and often in organizations, when we're trying to make decisions, is we come up with one narrative and one solution. And then we think we must follow that because we've now invested in that. And we don't do, again, the hard work of thinking how many options and solutions, potential solutions are there, and what are all the costs and benefits of those individual solutions. And the most important question people do not know the answer to is on what criteria do I judge these options? And I used to ask this when I was a board member and say, so on what criteria are we are we making a decision on these options? And people would blank over and go, don't know, haven't thought about it. So it's very important to say, you know, is one of my criteria work-life balance? Is one of my criteria salary? Is one of my criteria childcare? I mean, whatever. But, you know, what are the criteria? How do you use them to judge the right way forward? And just having some, really.
And can you use that for, I guess, not just sort of like career job change decisions, but say if you had to make a decision about going and having a very difficult conversation with a colleague, for example, mm-hmm. or if you're going to performance manage somebody, can you do that the same?
I think so, because there's lots of criteria there, I think, about when do I have that conversation? Where do I have that conversation? How do I have that conversation? And so, yes, again, how would I judge whether that conversation has achieved its aims or not? Is it a one-stop shop, or is it the opening of an ongoing conversation that we can come back to? So there's lots of things to think about, even when you're having a difficult conversation, about how you have it and what the bridge of courage looks like, the decision to have it looks like. What are the consequences if I don't have that conversation at all? What are the potential consequences if I do have that conversation? I think I may have mentioned before on the podcast, but one of the reasons I think I'm quite fascinated is that my mother, when I was a child, she would just go silent for maybe for days on end if you upset her. And so that made me in my head do all of that dialogue, you know, shall I have this difficult conversation with my mother? Shall I not have this conversation with her? What are the five different ways I might open that conversation that might enable her to join in rather than go off in a huff and not sulk for 3 days? So, you know, good training in a way to think, actually, you know, that's what we're doing all the time. We're weighing up in our mind, oh, you know, this is a tricky colleague. They might blow their top if I mention something that's a bit tricky. So do I just not bother and let it roll on? Or is it important enough that I speak up? Or how do I do it?
So you're really weighing up the pros and cons, but more than that, you're saying the outcomes, actually, what criteria are we actually looking for? But it's interesting what you said about consequences. What happens if I don't have that conversation or I don't do this? In my experience, we just don't ask ourselves that. We don't focus on the consequences. We focus on the potential problems that might happen if we do something, but we spend very little time on that. Why is that?
I don't think we want to go there. And so the consequence is that I find in most workplaces that people deny or avoid, you know, a difficult situation. And then the consequence is that that goes on for weeks, months, or even years. And I spoke to somebody who worked in an NHS department who said, well, this difficult situation has been going on for 5 years, 5 years. And I've never found a way to speak up about it. But you see, when we don't speak up about something that isn't right or that is impacting us and we allow it to roll on for months and years, it's as though that's acceptable. And then you have to think, well, what's the impact on the organization or the practice or the hospital department as a whole? And how many other people are suffering because I'm not speaking up and we're not speaking up? And so we allow situations that shouldn't persist to persist because we don't have the courage to speak up. And I appreciate that, you know, very often people are maybe frightened of losing their job. So there is a real consideration to be had. Well, if I speak up, am I going to be, you know, am I going to be a whistleblower? Am I going to lose my job potentially? And we do then have to think about that as a consequence as well. Well, I can't afford to do that. Are there any other options? You know, but these are the very, very challenging questions. And I don't have the answers to those, unfortunately. But that's the work we need to do, is to say, well, if I'm not speaking up, what's the consequence for me? What's the consequence for my health of just carrying this burden, if you like, and not saying anything?
That phrase in my head, going through my head, what you tolerate, you teach. It's really hard, really hard. So you've worked out what criteria you're judging this decision on. And actually, I find that the best way to do that for me, I've got a colleague who always says, what does good look like? What does good look like? Actually, what would a really, you know, great outcome in all these different ways actually look like? So that helps you get over the bridge to actually say, you know, good looks like being able to work alongside this person, for example. So actually, that is more important than make me losing faith or, you know, et cetera. So you don't get just stuck in this abyss, which it's fear, isn't it? And ego. I'm thinking ego.
Pretty much ego. We are all ego driven and we have to recognize it, all of us. Yeah.
How do we get over that?
I think it is personal awareness. It is awareness that that is what's going on. And how can we be more aware of our impact on situations and on others? It is just that sort of raising of awareness, that growing in awareness. I think that's it. It's just a journey, isn't it? To know that, to recognize those times where it's our ego speaking and not us. And most of us don't want to think about that, I think. So a lot of this and a lot of, I guess, the reason I've written this book is that it is a personal, every decision we make, every conversation is also part of a personal journey that we go on. And we have the opportunity in each of those situations to grow a little bit more by having thinking, oh, I handled that well, or I didn't handle that well, or here's what I think about life and this situation. Every little journey is part of life's journey, if you like. So this book represents individual journeys, mini journeys, you know, conversations, meetings, decisions, but it also represents life's journey.
And is there anything else that tends to be a real blocker for us on this journey?
Well, I think once you get, and I think we're almost talking about that, but once you've made your decision, you've still got a path to go on, which is why, you know, you're only at base camp then. You've still got to climb the mountain. And, you know, there's a part on the mountain, which I call the deep, deep, dark woods. And that is about this shadow journey. You know, what's in our shadow? What are the things we don't recognize that we haven't yet seen? And even when you start out on a journey, even if it's going on holiday, you know, there are things that you haven't yet thought about or that are going to surprise you or that are kind of come up. And we have to acknowledge it's not just because you've made a decision and it's a positive decision and it's aimed at taking you to a better place. You're only at base camp. You've still got a large part of the journey to that mountaintop to get to. And just recognizing that there are still shadowy parts to go through and difficult times and rough terrain and things like that.
And just because it's difficult doesn't mean it's wrong, right?
No, exactly. And I do feel, Rachel, I wrote a blog post about this. I do feel we live in a time where we are addicted to comfort and convenience. You know, everything's there at a click of a button. You ring Amazon or you post it, you know, you order something off Amazon. It's here within hours. That's mad. You know, you can get Uber, food delivered to your door. You can have your water temperature, any temperature you like in the morning. We live in this time of absolute comfort and convenience, but also crisis. And we're also addicted to crisis. So we lurch from crisis and then we think, no, I want to go back to comfort. Who or what can put me back in that place of comfort and convenience? And actually, if we understand that the inconvenience and the discomfort is part of the journey and part of the growing, then we're not constantly cycling between crisis and comfort and convenience.
I think it's interesting, Jane, you talk about the difficulties. And I mentioned earlier about this, that basically you need to have very deep connections and deep relationships with people. But I don't know any deep relationships where I'm working very closely with someone or in my family where there isn't some difficulties and there isn't that the hard work to do with being vulnerable and saying, oh, actually, that was a bit hurtful and that was a bit difficult. And can we get through this? It just doesn't happen. And if we then just sweep stuff under the carpet and don't address it, then, yeah, we might have an okay relationship, but there's always hidden resentment and hidden stuff, isn't there? And so it's tricky, but it's
really... So I guess that's why I write a book, which is a little bit more lighthearted, because this stuff can be quite heavy and you think, oh, no, I really don't want to do that kind of, you know, I don't want to go there and I don't want to have to do this hard work. But actually, it should be a bit more lighthearted. You know, my values are to listen, to learn, to love and to laugh. And I think the laughter bit, the humour and humility are the biggest things for me. You know, we've got to approach all of this with humour and humility and say, actually, it's not all about me. And I can have some fun on this journey as well. And that is the whole point, really, for me of writing about a mole, really, is to think, well, look, let's just have some fun with this. Let's, you know, we've got to go on this journey, but we might as well enjoy it.
I did a podcast a few weeks ago with Ida Bouvier, who's written a book about leading with your right brain. And it's all about metaphors, stories, being creative. And something like this, while it seems very simple, it definitely isn't. But you can just grasp concept. Like you immediately say you've got a high mountain to climb. We all know what that means. You know, a journey. We all know what the journey means, a swamp of despair or reality. It's really, really helpful for us to grasp some quite difficult concepts. So I think it's really helpful. And actually, next time I have a decision, I'll be like, oh, okay, swamp of reality. What do I really want here? What's going on? I do want to just pick up this thing about the ego, though. I think if we can just get over the ego, I read a quote and I don't know who it was by. Someone said, if you don't mind who gets the credit, you can achieve anything in this world.
Isn't that true? Yeah. And I've been in so many situations where people are claiming credit for something. You think, no, I did that, or I was part of that. And you're just saying, oh, it was all me. It doesn't matter. And yet it does matter because, you know, it's one of the things that does pull us all down into that nowhere abyss.
I think particularly in relationships, you know, we had a bit of a set to in our house yesterday for something very trivial. And I went to bed fuming because, like, but I was right. I was right. Why can't they all see that? I was right.
Yes, I told you so.
And I was right, by the way. So I've had the last word, ha ha. None of them listen to the podcast. Apart from my mum. Oh, and my brother. Apparently my brother. Hello, Christopher, in Australia. He listens.
Oh, how wonderful.
Chris, I was right. You know. And then half, you know, I fumed for a bit. And then I settled down and I went, you know, Rachel, like, what do you want to achieve? Like, whose side are you on anyway? Like, is this your family? You know, why do we have to acknowledge that you were right? You would do anything for these people. Yet you can't even just, like, let it go. I thought, let's just check the ego. It just doesn't matter if I was right or not. It actually doesn't matter. The criteria, what does good look like? Actually, good looks like good relationships with these people who know that I'm not going to fight tooth and nail with them just to prove that I was right. Oh, I don't know. But people, you know, I've heard that argument as like the who was right argument is like a fight to the bottom.
You know, again, we do live in a time where many, many people are relying on victimhood. And it's not that we shouldn't be, again, compassionate and empathetic to others, but, you know, we have to move out of that. But what can we do to relieve that situation rather than what can we do to wallow in the misery of being a victim?
And this isn't that you let everyone walk over you and you're constantly taking other people's naughty monkeys, taking their shit on top of you. And definitely not. But there is that line about, actually, where do I just stop fighting the battle here to save face?
Yes, we could probably do a whole podcast on ego, Rachel, but we'll leave that for another time.
Judging by what I've just told you. We'll call it a therapy session, Jane, and, you know. So I would suggest everyone get the book. It's great. It won't take you very long to read. It's a lovely little book, and you can just leave it around, lying around the house in the bathroom. Sorry, I don't mean to disparage your book, but I think it's great. If you put it next to the toilet, people will look through it and read it.
Well, this is what's happening, Rachel. It's disappearing in people's households. So when I send a copy or a copy arrives, it's apparently sort of, you know, somebody's wife or their child is pinching it and they go, where's that book gone? Oh, yeah, I've got it. Oh, that's happening.
You need to leave it where it's going to be found, which is why I suggest, you know, put it in your bathroom, you might read in the bath. Anyway, if you were sort of to summarize our conversation with like three top tips, what would it be?
Okay. I mean, just recognize that every decision, every dialogue, every meeting is all a journey. So you've got these micro journeys, then you've got your life journey, and that you do need a map and you do need a compass and you do need some guides. But at the end of the day, it's up to you. Self-determination is the key principle. You decide. And enjoy the journey.
Thank you. I mean, I've learned a lot along the way from you, gosh, with all the different podcasts, but also this little book. And it's just those images, actually. I think the thing I'm really taking from this is the thing about the tiger versus the eagle and actually being able to identify those people. And it's not a value judgment on, oh, you're a mean person, you're a tiger. It's just actually the tiger's in it with you and probably not going to be very independent. Choose your eagles carefully in certain. It might be different for different decisions, right?
Definitely.
Jane, thank you so much for being with us. If people want to get hold of you, where can they find you?
My website is janegunn.co.uk. If you want to find the book, you just add /mole/, or it's not, I think it's not yet on Amazon, but if you search Jane Gunn, The Mole and the Mountain, that'll come up on Google as well.
Perfect. We'll put the link in the show notes as well. So Jane, yeah, we'll get you back to talk about ego. That'll be a good one. I'll have to have a bit of therapy before I come on, I think, and then it'll be okay. Brilliant. And we'll speak soon. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget, we provide a self-coaching CPD workbook for every episode. You can sign up for it via the link in the show notes. And if this episode was helpful, then please share it with a friend. Get in touch with any comments or suggestions at hello@youarenotafrog.com. I love to hear from you. And finally, if you're enjoying the podcast, please rate it and leave a review wherever you're listening. It really helps. Bye for now.